Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The path to reconciliation is one of listening, learning, and growing together. A path that recognises the central place of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our past and in our future. It is in that spirit that we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay tribute to elders past, present, and future. Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy issues facing Australia and the world. Policy Forum Pod is produced by the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. I'm Sharon Bessel, and I'm here with my wonderful co-host, Anna Greta Hunter, and we have reached the final episode for 2023.
Sharon, it's amazing to be with you today. It is hard to believe that this year is over. It's been an extraordinary year. Barry Jones just recently described it as perhaps the worst in half a century, and it's certainly one that's brought many policy challenges. Over the course of this year, on this pod, we have explored housing and the cost of living crisis. We've reimagined social policy. And of course, we have had some incredible conversations about the Uluru Statement from the Heart and the referendum on an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice to Parliament. Those conversations remain some of the most powerful and important we've had on this podcast, and I know that they're going to remain important for us to go back to over the many years ahead. But today we're going to reflect on the year that was and look forward to 2024, and we have two remarkable guests to join us. And I'm sure both of them will be well known to our pod listeners. We've got John Falzon and Thomas Mayo. Perhaps I could start by asking the two of you to introduce yourselves. John, can we start with you?
Thanks very much, Anna Greta, and it's just lovely to be here with you again, you and Sharon, and to be joined by my dear friend Thomas is indeed a real treat at this time of the year. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that I'm joining you from unceded Ngunnawal country and pay my respects to elders past and present. My name is John Falzon. I'm a poet, a sociologist, a writer. I'm recently delighted to have been appointed a visiting fellow at ANU's School of Regulation and Global Governance, and yes, I'm really looking forward to the conversation today.
John, it's fantastic to have you with us. Thomas Mayo, I know all of our listeners, in fact, will know who you are, but would you mind introducing yourself for those who may not have heard you speak?
Thank you, Anna Greta. Thank you, Sharon. Good to be with you, John. I'm a Larrakia country, and that's where I live. I acknowledge the Larrakia people, elders past and present. I'm a Torres Strait Islander myself, Kukugal Erabumle, and Karareg Aboriginal man. I was a wharfie for 16 years, became an official of the Maritime Union of Australia, was seconded for a while in the campaign for the Uluru Statement from the Heart, a leader in the referendum campaign this year, and now Assistant National Secretary of the MUA on some long service leave for a little while before I hit the ground running back into industrial relations.
Thomas, I think if anyone deserves some long service leave, it's you. And of course, you're also an author who's written some very beautiful books. And so here we are with two of the most beautifully articulate people in Australia. And I'm feeling under pressure to kind of frame some questions in a beautiful, articulate way. But we'll see how we go. 2023 has, as Anna Greta said, been quite a year. There are real challenges associated with our emergence from pandemic restrictions. We've got the ongoing housing crisis, a deepening cost of living crisis here and globally. And against that's all playing out against the backdrop of horrendous wars in Ukraine and in Gaza. John, You wrote an article for The Guardian back in 2020, which I often reflect on, and you talked about the obscene levels of casualisation and precarity, the failure to invest in community infrastructure, in social services and disability services, and you highlighted the need to prioritise health and healing. Since 2020, we've had some really significant changes. And importantly, as you pointed out in the wake of this year's federal budget, we've seen some very significant shifts in the federal government's narrative, in their priorities and their approach in key policy areas. John, if you were to give the government an end-of-year social justice report card, what would your assessment be, particularly on key issues around equity, health and healing?
Oh, geez. So, yeah, thanks for starting with the easy question, Sharon. Look, the way I am reading the performance of the Labor government thus far is that that we have been bequeathed, over 30 years of fairly vicious neoliberal policies. Not just individual discrete policies, but an entire way of understanding society, understanding who we are, understanding the role of government, and understanding the role particularly the role of class in all of that. So, that the two main trajectories within neoliberalism, of course, were that sort of crushing of the political agency of ordinary people, particularly through the union movement, but also the gutting of social infrastructure, for the purpose of privatising, of commodifying, of taking away people's systems of support. And so there's a massive task to sort of reorient not just the economy, but the way we understand society and the role of government. Has the current government begun to do that? I would argue yes, in a fairly modest way, but a not insignificant way. So, the fact that we have seen a rethink in the area of workplace relations, I think, should not be in any way underestimated. That's a very important change, the fact that we're talking about precarity in the workplace and the need to address some of the structural drivers of that deliberate precarity. Have we done nearly enough in the area, for instance, of housing, of improving indeed reconfiguring our social security system? I would say no. We saw some movement on housing, and again, that's not insignificant. It's not enough, but we need to see, I believe, a far bolder vision that completely changes the way we think about housing as a society, so that it is no longer a speculative sport, but actually a human right. And the same with our social security system, and indeed the same with climate justice. This is not something that is in the abstract. This is something that is touching all of our lives, and indeed is putting a massive dent into whatever sense of hope many younger people are struggling to maintain.
John, thank you for kind of starting us off with that reflection. I think your reflections on not just the short term, but the longer term are always so powerful and insightful. And I think that removal of agency that you talk about is something that I see in my research all the time with children who are growing up in contexts of poverty and their families. And so reflecting on that last comment you made about hope, and one little girl who was involved in our research this year who was 10, we asked her to write, or we asked the children to write messages to people who make decisions that impact on children. And this little girl wrote to the Prime Minister. She said, "Dear Prime Minister Anthony, can you please give children who have no opportunity some hope?" I think when you have 10-year-olds making those kinds of reflections, it shows where we've landed after those decades of neoliberal neglect. But Thomas, I'd love to hear your reflections on the year, and particularly perhaps whether there are any high points that we can hold on to in what has been a pretty tough year.
Yeah, no, it's certainly been a tough year, very intense campaigning for myself, you know, from the very beginning. I was home only 25 days till a week after the referendum. An awful result, you know, a result in that referendum that takes us back decades, I believe, you know, the type of campaigning brings us into, no campaign that we saw brings us into a whole new level of shamelessness about, you know, political lies and the use of race or racism as a weapon. But that, post-truth, you know, how they, how they stick to those lies until people start to believe them. We really saw that. And you know, the situation that, you know, we see in the world, Palestine, and Israel, Ukraine and Russia, just a whole lot of awful things that I think is causing, you know, a lot more tension in the world, and polarization is getting greater. Social media's effect, you know, so when you look at it all, it all looks a bit doom and gloom. But on the bright side, I think domestically, I think that seeing a government actually have a bit of courage to put a question to the Australian people in a referendum was a positive thing. Governments in the future might be shy about it for a long time to come, though, because it failed. But that in itself was something that was, I think, a change in the way that politics is done. I agree with John. They are beginning. We are seeing the beginnings of better policies and government, acting more in the interests of the people, but at the same time, you know, too short from where many of us would like to see them, and many Australians desperately need the government to take action. I'm most frustrated, though, I think, with how how terrible the coalition were in government for, you know, almost 10 years, inaction in Indigenous affairs, in all of these social areas, going backwards, the gap widening, not just for Indigenous people, but, you know, workers' rights being under attack, all of those things, and just the dishonesty, you know, all the way to the level of the Prime Minister with the multiple, you know, ministerial portfolios that were were a secret and only found after they lost government. I think, it's really frustrating to then see, you know, a government that is much better doing, you know, much better, but still getting the blame in the way that, you know, this, do you understand what I'm saying? It's just really frustrating. They've been in power for, you know, 18 months thereabouts, and trying things, and yet the coalition is there just, you know, and people believe them, you know, and that's something that that, you know, is a bit of a summary of where my head is at. We've got to do something to wake people up, as we always try to do, right, John?
Absolutely. Wake people up to the enormous potential we have to bring about social change that, you know, indeed the history of progressive social change is written by ordinary people, you know, under the guiding stars of struggle and hope, changing what seemed to be unchangeable. You know, I always think about Nelson Mandela saying, you know, it always seems impossible until it is done.
Yeah, and on that point, you know, I'm ending the year with hope, absolutely ending the year with hope. I'm looking to how we can take the lessons from this referendum this year, and what we've experienced, and help people to understand. I'm going to write a book, another handbook, that might give some people some tools.
I do think that one of the glimmers of hope that we see is that after years of just not listening, we are starting to listen to people. I mean, despite the heartbreaking outcome of the referendum, it allowed us to have conversations that we haven't had before and to hear from people whose voices have been completely marginalised. And I think across the policy spectrum, there has been more listening over the last 18 months than we've seen in the last three decades. And that gives hope.
I think there's some evidence of that. You know, one of the remarkable things that we found through the referendum was that the beginning of the year, a poll was done to see how many, you know, what the level of understanding of Indigenous issues were in the public. And it was only around 15% that said that they understood, you know, the issues that Indigenous people face. In the week before the referendum, that was at around 50%, you know, close to what the actual outcome was. So I think there was, the referendum might have failed, but I think we were forced as Australians to have those conversations at kitchen tables where it had never happened before. We saw people that had never campaigned before shift others around them, you know, people that wouldn't consider themselves activists. I think that was a discussion that takes us closer to where we want to be, more people understanding. And the other remarkable bit of, I saw a poll that was done that said that no voters, around 70% of them, still believe that Indigenous people should have a voice. I mean, it's mind-boggling, you know, like the contradiction there. But I think that tells us that, you know, there is still that goodwill was there, but people were too easily misled to think the worst of us, you know. And it reminds me of Noel Pearson's Boyer lecture, you know, where he says that we're a much unloved people, people can easily be led to think the worst of us, you know.
I think the two of you have already done this remarkable job of showing us hope through what has been an extraordinarily challenging year. And I'm struck that in some of the work I do on climate change, just how powerful it is being able to use the words climate change to be able to discuss the issues. And so this encouragement of discussion and the associated listening that goes with conversation, I think really has been powerful. Thomas, you've already written a beautiful piece for Mianjing, Defying Racism with Love and Care. And I would love to hear you flesh out a little bit more on where you would like us to go from here. Where do we go from here? How do we contend with the polarisation? And I have to say, for me, there were multiple points of deep distress from the results of the referendum. But one of the tremendously concerning parts is the deep polarisation and polarisation in information, where we get our information from, what set of truth we might be working with. How do we bridge these divides? Where do we find the hope in that awful polarisation of politics?
Yeah, look, it's not an easy answer, because I think anybody that supported the campaign and had the conversations, as you know, we were so important to do, would have found that there were those in our close circles, you know, friends or family, that believed the, you know, absolute rubbish, you know, about the voice, you know, if it was passed, that they may lose something, or that it would cause chaos, or that, you know, it was a land grab from the United Nations. And I think any of us that had those conversations just found how difficult that was, that people really believe, you know, what they might find on Facebook, you know, from untrustworthy sources that are about disinformation and fear-mongering. And so I think we need to find a way to have those conversations, though, because perhaps it's not taking them on the matter of what happened on the 14th of October. I think we need to find, and I say to our supporters, and of course I'm going to say, you need to continue to have those conversations, continue to have conversations to bring people over to understanding, but not on what happened this year. I think find other paths to having a greater empathy and desire to see change in Indigenous affairs. I think also it's so important that we, you know, in universities or any other opportunity we have, to put things into place to help the next generation have a good understanding of where reliable information can be sourced, and I think that's already happening. You mentioned earlier, you know, that young person's comments. You know, I think there's plenty of examples of young people having a better idea because they're born into social media somewhat.
John Falzon, I would love to hear your thoughts on this too, and particularly your reflections on the referendum and then perhaps on mechanisms of repair. And Thomas has given us so much to think on there. But what are your thoughts?
I was gutted, of course, and but at the same time, you know, I remain filled with an incredible tenderness, you know, towards, well, you know, the courage of the First Nations peoples coming together at Uluru, an unprecedented and beautiful articulation of an injustice and a vision for the future. You know, it reminds me of Paulo Freire's, you know, the Brazilian theorist, you know, who spoke very beautifully about the need to engage in a prophetic denunciation of the bad news in order to engage in a prophetic annunciation of the good news, that, you know, there is always a way forward. So I you know, between what happened here and what is happening internationally, I just was really plunged into a deep sense of needing to reflect on what it all means. And one of the things I spent some time on was studying the work of Gabor Maté, the Canadian physician who's done some amazing work on trauma, an incredible tome that he's written recently called The Myth of the Normal. And he speaks about trauma, you know, being that an event is traumatizing when it renders us diminished, which is to say physically or psychically more limited than before, in a way that persists. And, you know, in a sense, these, to me, these are all structural acts of violence and violation, you know, when we deny people, you know, the respect that is their due as First Nations people, but, you know, in the same way, you know, both here and internationally, the same with the work of patriarchy and denying the respect that is due to women and gender diverse people, and indeed the machinations of neoliberal capitalism, which denies that respect that is due to the people who carry out the work across the globe, including the heavily gendered and mostly unpaid work of caring done primarily by women, and the people who have been residualized into, you know, into the army of the unemployed, as well as the people engaged in informal work. So, you know, we need to focus on what it is that that drives the instruments that traumatize us as a society. And Joy Harjo, the North American First Nations poet, she puts it very beautifully. She says, "Fear is a potent elixir that motivates enemies, and there can be no enemies when there is no fear." And I think everything that Thomas was describing there with that, you know, vicious campaign of very deliberate lies was all predicated on maximizing that sense of fear of what would happen, for instance, if we had a resounding yes result from the referendum. But, you know, we don't just stop with the way that fear is weaponized. We need to remember that this is something that has happened historically, you know, in all those forms of structural dispossession. And Silvia Federici, the great feminist scholar, you know, she points out that that what's most essential in any system of dispossession and violence is to condemn those who are dispossessed and violated. And so, you know, once we speak about these things, you were saying, Anna Greta, about, you know, naming the climate crisis for what it is. Once we acknowledge and name these forces that are at work, then I believe we can transform that very negative fear into something akin to hope. But it has to be collective. That's the great lesson. I think the referendum campaign, the Yes campaign, was a beautiful outpouring of collective love and hope and defiance against the lies. We need to not be afraid to build on that. And Thomas and I, had this conversation a little while ago, and we both know it from our membership of and activism within the union movement, and that is, we fight, we fail, we fall, we get back up, and we dust ourselves down, and we fight again. But our fighting is not a fighting born of fear; it's a fighting born of love, a fighting born of hope.
Thomas, you said earlier that you had spent 25 days at home up until October of this year, and you spent that extraordinary amount of time travelling around Australia, talking with people about the Uluru Statement from the Heart, having conversations around the voice. Can you share with us perhaps what you learned about us as a nation from those conversations, but particularly how we can move forward in having conversations that shift us from fear to the kinds of hope and love that John talks about?
I think what was interesting throughout the last 6 years of campaigning, so since the making of the Uluru Statement from the Heart and hitting the road really for most of that time, most intense from when Labor was elected in May last year, though, was that in conversations, in these, when you can have discussions with people that are open-minded enough to listen and to consider what you've got to say, when we had the opportunity to present the facts in black and white, but also, directly face-to-face with people, and to look them in the eye, I always saw people shift to support. It was very, very rare that anyone would be, dead against it in those discussions. And always, I did try to, and it's hard to do, but to try to, get out of our own bubble, you know what I mean? Try to find audiences that needed to be persuaded. And so that I found really interesting. When the referendum was announced, and particularly when Peter Dutton decided to make it about race himself, to take that racist path of saying that this was divisive on race, which it was not. Indigenous peoples being, a distinct people because of our connection to this place, our long history and culture and our sovereignty that was never ceded. And we needed to reach masses of Australians, and you couldn't do that in similar forums to what I've been doing and had been doing. That's when it became much harder, I think. I guess my point is, it's so important for us to continue to try and influence those that are close to us, that trust us, and to go against what I think our enemies try to do, which is to polarize us and cause us not to have those conversations with each other, to cause us to be fearful of having a discussion about politics, because it might end up in a blue. Anyway, wasn't very articulate the way I put it, but yeah, that's what I think.
I think it's incredibly articulate, and those themes of trust, of building connections and of caring for one another as we talk about difficult issues are themes that we continually talk about.
Yeah, I mean, when people got to know us, right, and again it goes to this, what Pearson was talking about last year in the Boyer lectures, other polling shows that very few Australians have actually met an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person and consider us, as friends, have a relationship. And, you know, I found that there were a lot of people that I met that were passionate for the Yes campaign that were not because of the so much about the policy itself, but because they had met us, because they'd had an interaction with us, because they'd gone to Uluru or something like that, or to, to a local event with traditional owners in Melbourne even, you know, and they felt that they knew us and therefore weren't afraid of us and did not believe what, you know, Peter Dutton and the No campaign were trying to tell them, that we were out there to take something from them.
I think there's so much for us to take away from that and to reflect on. We are going to take just a very short break, but listeners, we're here with two committed unionists and social justice champions, and we do need to talk about justice in the workplace and industrial relations reforms. So we're going to do just that when we come back from the break. So stay with us.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Listeners, welcome back. We're here with John Falzon and Thomas Mayo talking about the year that was, and it was quite a year. The years ended with debates in Parliament around the proposed Industrial Relations Bill, with the government seeking to address a raft of issues from wage theft and pay-in conditions to workplace protections and support, and addressing the precarity of the gig economy. We don't have time today to talk in detail about these issues, but I would love to hear from both of you more about this in the years ahead. And I'd love to hear your reflections now on what needs to happen to industrial relations and to work in Australia. Thomas, you've been a unionist for much of your adult life. I wonder what your thoughts are on the recent events and the hope for the future.
Well, it's great to see progress in industrial relations, where the coalition were constantly trying to take the rights of workers away. We've seen a bit of progress. I haven't been watching it too closely, to be honest, you know, focusing on the referendum campaign. So I couldn't tell you a lot about what was in the closing the loopholes bill. But I do see, you know, some great positivity towards it, which is great. I think there's a lot more that can be done, though. I think it's well short, you know, of reaching a point where there's balance and workers have the power that they need to get better outcomes. I think there's also, you know, there will continue to be a need for ongoing positive reform to give workers that are, you know, don't have access to their union, really, that aren't in traditionally organised areas of work. You know, the gig economy, I know there's been some changes for it, but I'm certain that there's a lot more that can be done. And that's what I'm going to be getting stuck back into when I finish my leave early next year.
When we've all read your book, very much looking forward to that. John, what are your thoughts?
I echo Thomas's attitude to this. It's long overdue. In fact, again, what we are seeing is the need to address some of the, you know, incredibly brazen attacks on the lives of ordinary working people that we saw during that long neoliberal period. And the fact of the changes in the structure of the labour market and the structure of the economy, I always say, you know, when an employer practices wage theft, or when they deliberately place someone, you know, classify someone as casual, or a contractor, when in fact they should be treated as a worker with all of an employee with all of the entitlements that should entail. They do that for one reason, because they can. And so we need to completely reconfigure our structures so that they cannot, so that people, and it's not about being anti-business, it's about being pro-worker. It's about ensuring that people who go to whatever form of work they're engaged in, including, as you mentioned, Anna-Greta, the people working in the gig economy, people whose lives are incredibly precarious, that all people have the right to decent pay, decent and safe conditions, respect, a sense of dignity, and to be able to be able to afford the essentials of life. That's the other side of it. And the ACTU has been we've been having the Alan Fells led inquiry into price gouging. Again, why are we seeing the price gouging practiced by some corporations? Because they can. We shouldn't be depending on the goodwill or the good ethics of individual leaders of corporations. And I'm not for a moment saying there are none. I'm simply saying that that's not the way to run the show, to depend on people's goodwill. We need to structure in, to legislate, to make sure that corporations act in a responsible way to the people they employ, to the community that they provide services to the environment in which they operate, to the society that they actually reap so much profit from. We need to make sure that they contribute what is right as far as taxation, for example. So, we need to see this in a holistic way, and the closing the loopholes legislation, the suite of reforms there, what has been achieved in the past week is enormous, it's great kudos to the union movement, patiently ordinary people, ordinary working people, patiently telling their stories of what it is like to not be able to afford to have a place to live, to be working three jobs and sleeping in a car, or sleeping in a tent with their families, telling what it's like to have their lives endangered as delivery riders. And so we need to ensure that the rest of the legislation is indeed passed, that we see better rights for casuals, rights for gig workers on digital platforms, better rights for truckies and those in the road transport industry, and more support to stop wage theft. I remember speaking to some AMBOs, when the idea was, we would pass that legislation regarding to support for people suffering from PTSD and so forth. And the AMBOs were saying, yes, for sure, we want that. But, don't try and hive that off as if that's doable and the rest isn't, because, we are picking up the pieces of the, for the people who are exposed, differentially exposed to injury and death due to the current structures, particularly, and that they were thinking particularly in terms of delivery riders. But again, we saw it all during COVID, didn't we? If individual workers are plunged into that kind of precarious situation where they don't have paid sick leave, for example, when some of us are unsafe, all of us became unsafe. And that should really be the message that stays in our minds from that COVID era. Not that we're past that. You know, let us not forget. You know, that we're still living with the COVID pandemic. But you know, those two areas of, you know, the respect that is due to workers, and the absolute essential role of the state in providing social infrastructure so that everyone has access to what they need.
John, as you're talking, I'm thinking about one of the first points that you made around sort of the legacy that we have of, you know, many decades of neoliberalism. And during that time, the narrative was very much that, you know, unions are a thing of the past, that the market can take care of workers. But we also saw the commodification of labour happening increasingly. And I'd love to hear, you know, and I'm thinking about the point that you make around when some of us are unsafe, all of us are so unsafe. And I would add to that, when some of us are exploited, all of us are diminished. And with those reflections, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what the future of the union movement is. Do we need to see a different role for the union movement? What would you like to see unions doing as we move forward into what may be a post-neoliberal world? John, would you like to lead off? And then I'd love to hear from you, Thomas.
I love that framing, Sharon, of a post-neoliberal world. Music to my ears. But you know, therein lies the contradiction and the challenge, and that is how we shape what happens next. Because if we collectively as ordinary people, if we do not determine the shape of the kind of society that we want moving forward, then others will do that for us, as they did before. You know, a lot of thought went into the neoliberal program. You know, many people aren't aware of what was called the Ridley Plan, put together, very little known, put together before the Thatcher years really began in earnest, and it laid out all of the steps towards crushing the union movement, atomizing the working class, ripping the guts out of social infrastructure in England. But, you know, we saw the same thing played out in various iterations across the globe, including here in Australia. So, you know, the union movement really needs to do two things. First of all, we need to be inclusive and ensure that the doors are open, that people know that this is their home if they want it to be. That there is meaning in being part of the union. That it's not simply an economic imperative, but a deeply spiritual one, in the sense that that sense of belonging, in this shared project of wanting to become more human together, to be able to create this kind of society where we can care for each other, for ourselves and for our planet, this collective venture. So the union movement, we need to really build on our beautiful story and to be aware of our own contradictions and where we can improve, where we can learn from our errors. But the second part is, of course, we need to be really clear in our thinking, in our envisaging an alternative future, and to start building it now. Mary Oliver, the great the American poet, says, "Keep some room in your heart for the unimaginable." And that goes two ways. Sadly, keep some room in your heart for the unimaginable violence and the unimaginable trauma that we see. But also keep some room in your heart for what we think is beyond the realm of the possible, because it is possible. You know, our challenge is to change the parameters sometimes very gradually, sometimes very quietly, without much fanfare, but to change the parameters of the possible. And we've come through this period. You know, it's not just the way employers have been allowed to act towards employees or to the community, but you know, you think of the role that the large consulting companies have played, what I call their very lucrative long march through the institutions, through the universities, through the ABC, through the public sector, reframing what all of those institutions should mean and trying to recreate them in the image and likeness of the corporation rather than in the image and likeness of the community that they exist to serve. So, we have our work cut out for us, but, I think it's a very exciting time to be in the position where we can build an alternative way of being together as a society.
Thomas, what are your thoughts on how we start to build that alternative and keep room in our hearts for the unimaginable?
Yeah, I think it's. I want to see the union movement grow. You know, I don't want to see this continuing decline. And I think it starts right now. Everybody listening to this, make sure you're a member of your union. Make sure all of your friends or families and friends and family are members of their union. Talk to your young people, you know, about making sure they understand the importance of a union, how they shouldn't take for granted all of those workers' rights that they enjoy, the entitlements that they have, annual leave, sick leave, you know, teach them about where all that has come from, domestic violence leave, you know, maternity leave, you know, those things more recent and the latest changes to bring us back. So, you know, I think it starts right now with all of us. And to John's point about we're talking about neoliberalism, I think the only way that we're going to see that end and something that, that is good for all of us is to build unions and make sure we're influencing it, because governments aren't going to do it, not even a Labor government, unless we're strong enough to make them stand up for us.
This is a conversation that I think both Anna Greta and I would like to keep going for another hour or two, or perhaps longer, but we will have to start to wrap up. And as we wrap up, we are approaching Christmas, and I wanted to end by asking each of you, including you, Anna Greta, what policy Christmas present you most want? What is the one policy change or initiative or development that you would really like to see take hold in 2024? And while each of you gathers your thoughts, I might just be really cheeky and jump in with the policy Christmas present I would like to see. And I do think one of the really exciting initiatives that we saw this year amongst all of the catastrophe that played out across the country and across the globe was the talk about a shift towards a wellbeing budget and a broader wellbeing economy. And I think that gives us the possibility of thinking in a much more human way and in a much more caring way about the priorities that we make. But my disappointment with the initial Measuring What Matters framework around a wellbeing economy was that it didn't explicitly talk about poverty, and it didn't explicitly talk about children, about intergenerational justice as it relates to child poverty. So this isn't going to surprise our listeners at all, but I think the policy Christmas present that I would like is next year for the government to commit itself to ending child poverty in this very wealthy country. This is something we can do. We have the tools available to us. We have the policies available to us. If only we, as you said so beautifully, John, create room in our heart for the unimaginable. And we've put ourselves in a position in this country where we've accepted child poverty and we've imagined that we can't change it. We can. And so that commitment from government and that commitment from society to give license to government to act to support all children in this country is what I would wish for. John, what's your Christmas wish?
Well, I can't beat that one, Sharon. That's just so beautifully put, and I completely support your Christmas wish. I suppose the way I have in the past framed, you know, how we go about achieving that is to really completely reimagine how government has the responsibility to protect us from precarity. And I've spoken before on your program about how Judith Butler frames precariousness as being something very natural, that we all need each other in order to live, that our lives depend on others, and that's a beautiful thing that builds solidarity and tenderness. But precarity is deliberately engineered, and it's engineered in particular economic interests. And we've spoken about precarity in the workplace, but, you know, what could be a more poignant and terrifying example of precarity than children living in poverty, children not knowing and having no notion of really feeling safe, because they know that their parents are doing everything they can to keep them safe, but life is subjected to this constant sense of danger, whether it's the danger of losing where you're living, or the danger of not having enough to eat. And I never forget the powerful stories that you have shared in your research, Sharon, of children not saying to their parents that they're hungry because they don't want their mother to give up her meal, which is what they know that their parent will do. So we need to understand that government can do what markets will not, and that is to provide that space, that architecture to protect us from precarity. And that means a social security system that actually does not leave people struggling battling below the poverty line every day, because that's an absolute disgrace for as long as we maintain social security payment levels that clearly do not let people live decent lives. But linking that to the precarity in the workplace, the precarity of the housing crisis, the precarity of having communities and environment destroyed and fragmented. So we need to think very holistically about all of these areas, and not see it as, to me, the greatest danger politically is always to residualize and exceptionalize the people who are experiencing that sharpest edge of precarity and inequality and poverty, because then, our national psyche teaches us to do exactly what you've said, quite obscenely, to accept, because it's not us, because it's, people who've either fallen on hard luck or they've made bad choices. Well, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Yes, bad things happen that act as triggers, but, the fact that as a society we're not making sure that people are protected when bad things do happen, like the loss of a job or poor health or whatever the case may be, by default, if we're not supporting people structurally, not as charity, not as a favour, but as something that we should be proud of, if we're not doing that, then we're actually kicking them while they're down. And, my earnest Christmas wish is that, we have the guts to face up to the trauma that we are allowing to continue to happen on our watch, and to prevent it, and to create something very, very human in its stead.
John, that structural analysis is so critically important. We can't address child poverty unless we address poverty for all, we can't have a just society until everyone has their basic needs and their basic human rights met. And to achieve that, we need structural change. As you're talking, I'm thinking about a 9-year-old boy who said this year to me, you know, I have such happy memories of when I had a home. And this was a child who was homeless when he said that. We can't allow structures to continue that create those realities for children. Anna-Greta, I think we might come to you next and then to Thomas for a final word.
It's hard to add, I think, to what the two of you have already said. It's so extraordinarily powerful simply to start with getting rid of child poverty and to then look at the structures around that. For me, some of the glimmers of hope I've had in the work I've done this year actually has been looking at some of the dysfunction within the healthcare system and thinking about how our healthcare system struggles to provide the care that it really wants to give to the communities that it's part of. And it strikes me that there's real power in looking at where we're going, thinking about what values it is that drives either an organisation or a government or a collective or a community. And I'm really struck by some of the language we've heard today from these two wonderful guests, the language of love, the language of kindness, and really putting kindness and care at the centre of all of the policy that we do. Sharon, you and I have said so many times on this podcast over the years, imagine if caring for people and place was at the centre of every policy decision. Imagine if that was what drove what we did and why we did it. So that sort of shift in approach would be extraordinary.
Yeah, valuing care. Thomas, we would love to give you the final word in Policy Forum Pod for 2023. What policy Christmas present would you like?
Oh, geez, I love everything that you guys said are important, you know. But I suppose if I did have a wish, it would be for, you know, for the conflicts in the world to cease, for there to be peace. You know, it's the biggest wish you can possibly make, but why not? I think you guys have covered the policy stuff. That would be what I hope for 2024, but also an awakening, and that won't happen without us working, all of you people that are listening. Working to convince people to think, you know, and be conscious of what they do with their vote, what they do with their time, how they care enough to have to challenge themselves and have those tough conversations to help people see the way forward, which I think we've covered in this podcast. So thank you, guys.
Can I just say what an extraordinary privilege it's been to have the two of you with us today. John Falzon, it's such a pleasure to hear you speaking with us. I love your use of words and language, and your generosity of ideas is remarkable. But can I say a really special thanks to Thomas Mayo on behalf of so many of us around the country for the work that you've done this year. You have changed our thinking and you have opened our hearts to love and kindness in ways that I hadn't imagined at the beginning of this year. And I can really only thank you for that. So thank you for joining us today.
Hear, hear.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Sharon, that was the perfect balm to what I think Barry Jones put so well as one of the worst years in more than half a century. Extraordinary guests for an extraordinary time. And there's so many elements of today's conversation that I'm going to carry. And I hope that many of our listeners will find that this conversation is one that they can carry in their hearts as we approach the break. Listeners, this podcast is produced by ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy. As we end the year, we'd love to hear your reflections on 2023 and the Christmas policy presents you'd most want. So do reach out to us at the Crawford LinkedIn page or by email at policyforumpod@anu.edu.au. As we end the year, we want to thank you, our wonderful audience, for all of your support and engagement throughout the year.
And thank you to the Crawford School and particularly to our school director, Professor Janine O'Flynn, for the extraordinary support throughout the year. Thanks too to Hannah Scott for production and to Darcy Brumpton and Alex Jackson for background research. And thank you to our incredible guests who have joined us throughout the year for their generosity, for their expertise, their preparedness to share and provide insight, and for the care that they bring to challenging policy issues. And most of all, thank you to our guests for their incredible commitment to better policy outcomes for all of us. And Anna-Greta, I do want to thank you for being an extraordinary friend and co-host. This is always the highlight of my week to have these conversations with you. I wish everyone the peace and joy of Christmas and the best for 2024. May next year bring peace and see the end of the terrible conflicts that are destroying lives around the world, and bring greater equity, fairness and justice here in Australia and around the globe. We will be back in February with more insights into the policy challenges facing Australia and our world, and we do hope that you join us again then. But for now, from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for 2023.
And from me, Anna-Greta Hunter, Sharon, I'd just like to thank you. Thank you so much for the extraordinary work you do for this podcast. This podcast would not exist without you. You have carried us through an extraordinarily challenging year. We could not do this without you. And like you said, this is the highlight of my week. It's been extraordinary working with you. Very much hoping you have a wonderful break. And to all of our extraordinary support team from the Crawford School of Public Policy, thank you all for the work that you do. May next year be a better one. And so from me, Anna-Greta Hunter, we'll see you next year.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.